Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Migration Policy Institute's latest National Language Access Webinar, Language Access in Schools, Federal Requirements and School Experiences. I'm really glad to have you all on the call with us today. My name is Chandasi Pandya, and I'm a policy analyst with MPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy, and I'll be your moderator for the next 90 minutes. This webinar is being recorded, and audio for it, along with the PowerPoint slides you will see today, will be available on MPI's website at www.migrationpolicy.org. Today's webinar continues our series looking at promising practices, legal requirements, and challenges and opportunities for the provision of language access services to limited English proficient populations. I'm pleased to be co-hosting this webinar with Bridging Refugee Youth and Children Services, or BRICS. Before we begin, I wanted to go over just a few logistical items. If you have any problems accessing this webinar, please email our events manager, Lisa Dixon, at ldixon@migrationpolicy.org. That's L-D-I-X-O-N at migrationpolicy.org. We have three wonderful speakers today, and once they finish their presentations, I'll open up the floor to questions. That said, please use the chat function on the left-hand portion of your screen throughout the webinar to ask questions. I'll keep track of them throughout the webinar, and we'll try to get to as many as possible during the Q&A portion of this event. If I don't get to any question that you answer, please feel free to contact me directly, and I'll try my best to get it answered for you. If you'd like to ask a voice question during the Q&A, please press star 1 to alert us. For those of you unfamiliar with MPI, I wanted to take just a few moments to let you know about some of the language access resources that we've developed. In addition to this ongoing webinar series exploring current issues in language access, MPI's National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy maintains the Language Portal, an online digital library of over 2,700 language access documents from across the country. You can search for language access plans, translated materials, sample contracts, and other guidance by state, topic area, or document type. For example, you can find iSpeak cards in numerous languages, translated school enrollment forms, and different school districts' language access plans. I encourage you to send us your school's translation and interpretation documents to include on this valuable resource. The Center's work on language access is aimed at connecting federal, state, and non-governmental language access practitioners to discuss how best to meet federal requirements for providing language access to LEP communities. We believe language access is a core piece of immigrant integration and that effective communication with LEP communities dramatically furthers this two-way process. In addition to helping integration efforts, the provision of language access services is enshrined in Title VI of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. This is the first of the many legal precedents we'll discuss today. As you're aware, Title VI prohibits discrimination based on race, color, or national origin in programs and activities that receive federal funding, and discrimination based on English proficiency is included in this. In 2000, Executive Order 13166 clarified federal funds recipients' responsibilities under Title VI. This order has had a tremendous impact on the field of language access, and countless schools, courts, hospitals, and other human services functions across the country have entered the fold as a result. It's important to note that while the executive order didn't create new obligations, it did create a framework for programs to follow in order to meet existing ones. Specifically, Executive Order 13166 noted that federal agencies and recipients of federal funding must take reasonable steps to ensure that LEP individuals have meaningful access to their programs and activities. What constitutes reasonable steps to ensure meaningful access is contingent on four factors, according to the federal government. First, the number or proportion of LEP persons eligible to be served or likely to be encountered by a program. Second, the frequency with which LEP individuals come in contact with a program. Third, the importance of the services provided. And fourth, the resources available to the recipient. These four factors, along with other guidance provided by the federal government, have helped entities across the country better meet their missions by helping them structure and implement translation and interpretation programs. It's important to note that in addition to Title VI and the guidance provided under the executive order, other legal precedents exist for the provision of language access services. The purpose of today's webinar is to highlight these varied precedents, specifically within the school's context, and hear from two school districts, Denver and St. Paul, and see how they've managed them. To help review these various requirements, we at the National Center on Immigrant Integration Policy have teamed up with Lynn Moreland and Laura Gardner of BRICS for this webinar. BRICS recently published an excellent overview of language access requirements in schools, and they will review these to start us off. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce first Lynn Moreland, who is a longtime practitioner of cross-cultural social work and is director of BRICS. There, she oversees and develops all aspects of BRICS website and technical assistance and provides consultation nationally on services to refugee and immigrant children. It is also my pleasure to introduce Laura Gardner, BRICS's education technical assistance specialist. Laura coordinates BRICS's technical assistance with refugee school impact grantees and is the main contact for all school-related issues. In addition, she coordinates work on the BRICS website and clearinghouse and contributes to research and writing to BRICS publications. I'd like to now turn the floor over to Lynn Moreland. Lynn?
Thank you, Chandasi. Hi, everyone, and I want to welcome you all to this webinar on behalf of Bridging Refugee Youth and Children's Services, or BRICS, and we are really excited to be co-hosting this webinar together with MPI on a topic that's so critically important to providing access to a quality education for immigrant and refugee children. According to the Future of Children, about one-third of the kids in our classroom will be children of immigrants in just 10 to 15 years. So this is a really important issue in itself, but it also means that language access is an issue for a large and growing number of students and for virtually all of our nation's school systems today. Okay, so who are we? BRICS is a project of the U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops, Migration and Refugee Services, and MRS serves foreign-born children and families from all over the world through services, advocacy, and technical assistance. And the heart of our work is to raise awareness about the needs of immigrant and refugee children and to network with other leaders in the field to improve services to this population. BRICS is the National Technical Assistance, or TA, provider on refugee children, youth, and families for the Office of Refugee Resettlement of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And we provide TA to all agencies, including refugee resettlement, ethnic community agencies, and all nonprofit and public agencies like the schools. We have a special initiative of TA to the Office of Refugee Resettlement's Refugee School Impact Grantees. So we support schools located in areas where more refugees are resettled, and we've produced a number of tools through this public-private partnership. And of course, language access is a key issue for family engagement and for children's overall success in school, really. So this is a goal that we're very committed to. And we just thought we'd mention our new work with Head Start's National Center for Cultural and Linguistic Responsiveness, and this is to improve refugee and immigrant early education opportunities and school readiness. So this is covering the continuum of education services. Okay, and what do we do? Please visit our website at www.brycs.org for more information about our technical assistance. And we have a number of publications now on interpretation. And we have a website and clearinghouse. The clearinghouse has about 4,500 reviewed and cataloged resources that can help you serve immigrant children. And we've produced hundreds of our own publications, all available for free download. So please sign up for our monthly newsletter and discussion list. And we have developed a schools toolkit that includes five resources now, five and growing, that address concerns of those working in the schools. And so our next presentation is an overview of the fifth tool in this toolkit. And this is about, as Chandasi was saying, federal requirements to provide interpretation and translation in the schools. And Laura Gardner heads up our technical assistance to the Refugee School Impact Grant Program and is our expert in this area. And what she'll do is talk about the main points of our tool next. So thank you, and here's Laura.
Thanks, Lynn. Hi, everybody. So Chandasi provided us with basic information about national origin discrimination based on Title VI and Executive Order 13166. And so now we're going to talk about a couple of policy memos and case laws that have to do with national origin discrimination in the school context. So first we have the 1970 memo, which is identification of discrimination and denial of services on the basis of national origin. And this federal memo clarified the Title VI requirements of school districts to provide equal educational opportunities to all children, regardless of national origin and language. Following that was Lau versus Nichols in 1974, This was the U.S. Supreme Court case which upheld the requirements articulated in the 1970 memo as a valid interpretation of the requirements of Title VI. And then there were two additional policy memos in 1985 and 1991, which just provided further clarity and reiterated what was in the 1970 memo. Okay, so people often want to know, where are the words interpretation and translation used in the previously mentioned policy memos and case law? So it's important to note here that the words interpretation and translation are not specifically used in the civil rights policy memos and case law that I mentioned, but they are indirectly addressed within the context of non-discriminatory and comparable access to education. So as you'll see here, the 1970 memo states, school districts have the responsibility to adequately notify national origin minority group parents of school activities which are called to the attention of other parents. Such notice, in order to be adequate, may have to be provided in a language other than English. So obviously, if you have bilingual staff, you may be able to provide that information in a language other than English, but if not, that it may require getting interpreters. Okay, so now I'm going to talk a little bit about specific references to interpretation and translation in the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, or as many of us know it, No Child Left Behind. It lists a number of items that must be provided to the extent practicable in a language parents can understand. So let's take a look at Titles 1 and 3. For anyone who's not familiar with Title 1, this is the program that's designed to help meet the educational needs of our children in our nation's highest poverty schools. And as you know, many refugee and immigrant students attend Title I funded schools in low-income neighborhoods. So the following items must be provided to the extent practicable in a language parents can understand. This includes information on the child's academic achievement, on the school's Title I plan, and then you'll see information about school improvement and supplemental educational services. For anyone who's not familiar with what that means, basically after a school fails to make adequate yearly progress for 2 years, they are identified for quote-unquote school improvement, and students have the option of transferring to another public school. Such schools must develop a school plan for how they will improve. Some of this may potentially change in the near future, as President Obama just released ESEA flexibility documents, which State Departments of Education are reviewing, but this is how it is in the law for now. And you'll see also parent involvement programs and policies need to be interpreted or translated so parents can actually participate in those. Annual state and local educational agency report cards, and then lastly, the parents' right to know. And that has to do with the professional qualifications of their child's teachers. So Title III, this is the main funding source for limited English proficient students and immigrant students. So like before, these items must be provided to the extent practicable in a language parents can understand. So the reasons the child has been identified as LEP and is in need of a language instruction educational program, the child's level of English proficiency and academic achievement, information about the various program options. So does the child have the option of going into a newcomers program, or is it going to be sheltered instruction, or bilingual ed, that kind of thing. And then lastly, the information about a parent's right to decline to enroll their child in such a program. Now let's look a little bit at the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act. This is referring to special ed. These services must be provided in the native language. So IEP team meetings, IEP stands for Individualized Education Program. IEPs, those are the plans that students who need special education, sort of like a learning plan, and usually at least once a year, teachers, parents, school counselors, social workers, psychologists, et cetera, will get together, and with the parents, they put together this plan for their children's education. So those meetings need to have interpreters. Assessments and other evaluation materials used to assess a child, written notice that the school proposes to initiate or change the plan for the child, and then the last two just have to do with informed consent and right to confidentiality. So what to do if federal requirements are not met? The first few on here are primarily for parents themselves or perhaps refugee and immigrant serving agencies that are helping refugee parents. So they might try requesting a meeting with the school administrators or the school board. Second, they might try contacting the State Department of Education. And BRICS, we can help facilitate this. We have contacts in most State Departments of Education. Third, you can consider filing a complaint with the Department of Education's Office for Civil Rights, otherwise known as OCR, or with the Department of Justice's Civil Rights Division. And each of their websites have very clear procedures for how you can go about doing that, and if you have trouble finding that information, you can ask us or MPI. And also there's examples of settlements on each of their websites. So, for example, Boston and some other school districts that just went through that process. And there's also links to that on the tool that I've been reviewing from our toolkit, and the link is in many of these slides. And then lastly, the last idea is sort of more appropriate for the school districts themselves. If you are a teacher or an administrator or someone who's on this call and you recognize that these needs are not being met in your district but you're not really sure how to go about fixing them, you can request technical assistance from OCR or from one of the Equity Assistance Centers. And it's a network of 10 agencies across the U.S. who are funded by the Federal Department of Ed to provide assistance to local school districts and state departments of education on equity issues relating to national origin, race, and gender. And we can help facilitate those connections as well. Okay, so I'm going to give a little state of the field right now before we turn it over to Sal and Alejandra. The next few slides, they're based on our work over the past years, 10, 15 years with schools, as well as a pretty thorough literature review. Okay, so who is doing the interpreting? There was a study done just last year by Dr. Payone and colleagues that was a survey of school counselors across the country, and they asked, who is doing the interpreting in your school districts? And they found bilingual staff members were the number one group, but this included people like secretaries, janitors, pretty much anyone who could speak the language that was in that building. And then the second group was teachers, and the third was the students themselves. Other folks, they have arrangements where the school districts will contract with refugee and immigrant serving organizations, and we have a number of examples of those on our website. We have a map of promising practices throughout the U.S. that you can click on to get some ideas of those. Third, school districts often contract with interpretation and translation vendors, such as TransAct and other ones like that. And then lastly, school districts may contract with individuals they locate through universities, word of mouth, so on and so forth. So how do school personnel access interpreters? The national study that I just referred to of school counselors, they found that over half had no mechanism at all for accessing interpreters. Some school districts, however, have centralized departments where teachers can submit requests, such as Denver and St. Paul, which we'll be hearing from their department heads. And then lastly, I should mention that bilingual staff and homeschool liaisons are often used, but this role sometimes requires clarification. If you have bilingual teachers, for example, who are primarily supposed to be teaching, or homeschool liaisons that are primarily supposed to be focused on parent involvement, and yet they are consistently pulled to do interpretation, that can be a little bit difficult, and so this usually requires some role clarification. What are interpreters used for? In the school context, they're used for communication with parents, parent-teacher conferences, other types of parent events, school activities, enrollment, orientation, so on and so forth. Interestingly, most of the literature is on their use by school psychologists, and there's a little bit of literature on their use by school counselors. There's very little literature on the overall need for interpreters for everyday activities, although as a technical assistance provider and someone who talks to schools day in and day out, we very well know of their need. Are they trained? Unfortunately, many times they are not. There are no national standards for school interpreters. In the study I've been referencing of school counselors done last year, over half of the school counselors surveyed did not know if the interpreters they used had been trained. In a study by school psychologists in 2004, they found that 26% of the school psychologists in their study used an untrained interpreter. And I thought this quote from a teacher was pretty interesting. This was a bilingual teacher who was pulled aside to do some interpreting pretty frequently, and she says, "I don't necessarily know all the technical language for that and all, and I find myself describing it in different ways, and I just pray and hope that they understand what I'm talking about." And the million-dollar question, how are they funded? There's very little literature on this exact question. Typically, local school district funds should be used. Some interpretation and translation may be funded by Title III or Title I, but districts must follow the supplement versus supplant principle. If you have questions about what that means, please refer to this Department of Ed webinar that was done in April on translation and interpretation for English learners for more information. And it's my understanding that the links aren't live right now, but then when we post it on the website, they will be live. So if you don't have a chance to write that down quick enough. And then lastly, there's a grant called the Refugee School Impact Grant, which you heard Lynn and myself mention a couple of times. And this is a grant from the Federal Office of Refugee Resettlement that is given to 36 states, and there's about 200 programs at the local level. Many school districts, most school districts, and then a number of refugee-serving agencies. And translation and interpretation is an allowable activity in that grant. And lastly, what are the challenges to providing interpretation and translation services in the school setting? So, like we just mentioned, funding always comes up as an issue, both anecdotally and in the study that was done. That's what they found was the number one issue. Second issue that they found in that study was that there was a lack of advocacy for hiring interpreters in the school setting. And lastly, that the key people, such as administrators and superintendents and so on, did not believe that interpreters were needed. The second point there's a lack of awareness of federal requirements overall, which is the main reason why we're doing this webinar. Third is the diversity of languages. While on the one hand, of course, this is a strength of both our schools and our country, on the other hand, for providing interpretation services, this can be a bit challenging. Most of the school districts we work with need to provide interpretation services in over 100 languages. Also, some school districts lack the connections that they may need with immigrant and refugee serving organizations that can be a huge resource for them as far as interpretation services. If you would like some assistance with connecting with those agencies in your community, that's also something that BRICS can help with. And lastly, as I referred to a number of times, there's limited published literature or documented best practices in the school setting, which is why we are so fortunate to have our speakers from Denver and St. Paul today.
Great, Laura, thank you so much. I just add that the challenges that schools are facing are being faced by, different federally funded programs and agencies across the country, and the extent to which we can engage in a dialogue to talk about resources and best practices, the better off we'll all be. I'd like to now turn the floor over to Salvador Carrera to tell us how Denver Public Schools has met their translation and interpretation requirements. Sal is the director of Denver Public Schools' Multicultural Outreach Office under the Communications Department. There, he is the lead host of a Denver Public School-sponsored Spanish language show named Educa Radio, an innovative radio program that covers education, immigration, family, and social integration issues. He also directs the publication of the DPS Spanish language newspaper, Educa Noticias. Sal?
Good afternoon, everybody. Thank you for having me on the call, and thank you all for joining us today. My name, again, is Salvador Carrera, and I'm the director for the Multicultural Outreach Office for Denver Public Schools, and the district's very happy to be part of this call. Besides the outreach activity that we do in this office, our office also handles the linguistic services needs for the district as well. Our district has always supported language services. They've actually supported them for over 25 years, although in different models and different capacities. The current model has only existed for about 2 years, and we're constantly changing and improving it. Let's start with the kind of overview for Denver Public Schools. These numbers are from last year, so that this gives you an idea of a snapshot of the demographic makeup of the district. Our preliminary numbers for enrollment this year will surpass 81,000 students, making it the largest enrollment period since 1976 for Denver Public Schools. The rest of these figures give you an idea of the huge diversity that exists in the urban district. The reform efforts to turn around poor performing schools is spelled out in what is called the Denver Plan, and it started in 2005 with our Superintendent Michael Bennett at the time. Now he's a senator, and has been continued with our current superintendent, Tom Boesberg. And basically, the 70-page plan, in effect, supports the work that we do because engaging and informing parents will strengthen our students and families to have better academic achievement outcomes. So the district's very supportive of everything that we do, the radio program, the language services, the newspaper, our involvement in events, because they know that we need to bridge that communication gap with parents, and I've received unprecedented support from the superintendent and the district in general. Moving on to the next slide. This slide kind of shows you the different languages that we deal with. We have about 124 languages that are spoken by students and families in the district. Of course, we handle all of these languages when it comes to special education requests, but we have more of a structured service plan for other services that are not related to special education. But as you can see, the majority of the language needs are in Spanish, and that's very consistent, I think, with many cities across the United States. And it makes up about 40%, more or less, with the new numbers that are coming out this year. I'm sure it'll surpass 40% of Spanish speakers in the district. The rest combined make up 5%, so a much smaller but yet as important language group. We're court-ordered by the Department of Justice in this district to support the English Language Acquisition Program for language groups over 100. So as you can see here, Mongolian, Swahili, and Twi don't quite make the 100 student group yet. But these numbers are adjusted every year, and some languages move in and out of the 100 group benchmark. The other support that we offer, and that's in all languages, is for special education-related requests, and that's due to federal law, as you just heard. Our office's mission is to build stronger links with parents in the community through multilingual communication support. DPS offers free translation and interpretation support in over 10 languages, and you'll see that which languages are we offer for free, and then which languages we have kind of a structured fee for service, just because of budget limitations and logistics. But we generally speaking, in most cases, we offer the services for free in at least 10 languages. Just to give you an idea of our human resource and structural needs for linguistic services, the linguistic services are on the left, and the outreach efforts are on the right. And speaking of outreach, I wanted to just to quickly point out that we have a partnership with the Colorado African Organization, which is a refugee support organization here in Denver. And they're recipients, one of the recipients for the Refugee Impact Grant that Lynn mentioned early in the presentation. They do great work with their team of navigators for different DPS initiatives, one of which would be like parent literacy. Another one would be helping us with expos, where we have all of the schools in one location and all of the families can go to one location and learn about the different schools, whether it be elementary or high school. Whatever. We have the navigators there to help the parents learn more about the schools. Over on the left side, I'll bring your attention back over to the left side, we have two project managers. One handles the translations request, and we really do manage projects because the translations request can vary from a simple document with 100 words to a complex project of 50,000 words, which then kicks in some additional resources. And besides the two full-time project managers for each interpretations and translations, we have four full-time Spanish linguists that translate and edit, and we have also at our disposal 12 part-timers that speak various languages and interpret, but also some of them translate. And we also work with three agencies that support our Spanish interpretation and translation needs, as well as languages other than Spanish needs. And to just touch on whether they're certified, qualified, how qualified are they, they've all gone through DPS testing, which then gives me an idea whether they qualify to work for us in whatever capacity. And on a scale of 1 to 5, all of our interpreters and translators must score 4.5 or better. And, of course, all of the interpreters that are brought to us from the agencies are certified by the agency. And for anybody that conducts special education meetings, they have to go through one-day training, voluntary one-day training, in order for us to use them. So if they don't go through that training, we don't use them for IEPs or any special ed-related requests. That gives you an idea of what the org chart looks like. Our translation process. Our linguistic services are modeled after a mini agency. As you can see here, looks complicated, but it's actually a good diagram on how the process works. We have separate online submissions for translation and interpretation, and those portals intake requests from DPS employees. Our project managers for each translation and interpretations, they assess the resources that are needed for each request, and then they triage accordingly. Some of them we can handle internally. Some of them will need to go to the part-time because of our workflow. Others will need to be outsourced to an agency, depending on the language need. So we take great pains in quality assurance before delivering the request. As you can see here, we need time to prep the documents. We need time to assign to a translator, and we base it on whatever language and resources we have at hand. And all along this process, there are email notifications that are fired off to the client, letting them know that we've received the request and that we've either agreed to their delivery date or we've assigned them a new target delivery date, depending on our pipeline of work. If the work is outsourced, we don't review it if it's outsourced, but if it's internal, we review it internally. And then as a final step, we run through a quality assurance check, we sign off on the project, we finalize the documents, we upload our translation memories, we do simple formatting. We don't really get into a lot of desktop publishing, but we wanted to also make sure that we deliver something that they can use. And then lastly, we fire off a survey to let us know what the satisfaction is of the client. So just in terms of volume, this is a graph that shows how much volume of requests we get. And last year we got 1,512 requests. And as you can see here, we've grown year over year over year, month over month. Since the 2008-2009 school year, we've grown 180% in requests, just in requests. And it doesn't really give you an idea of the volume because you have a request could be one page or it could be 70 pages, but just in terms of requests, this is kind of where we're at. Red is last year, blue is 2 years ago, and green is 3 years ago. So you can see there that the growth is very significant. But again, we want to move away from just relying on translation requests indicators, but we want to also track word volume, because word volume will allow us to better plan for budgetary needs in the future. And I think just simply tracking requests is not going to help me to find out whether our volume has increased in words. And we wouldn't be able to manage this volume of requests if we did not use translation technology tools. We wouldn't be able to keep up with the demand. As you just witnessed, there was quite a bit of growth, and once people like the quality and get into the habit of working with us, it just grows from there. And we've not only grown in Spanish, but in other languages as well. So we use SDL Trato Studio. We just migrated to 2011. With this software, we only have to translate a particular segment once. This is not auto-translation. It's far from it. This is a very sophisticated tool that allow us to, with cat tools and each segment is translated, then reviewed, and finally approved to be stored into our translation memory. And then it sits there until the next time a document comes across our path, and it leverages that approved translation into the document so that the only thing that translator has to worry about is any new segments that are in that document. So our efficiency has skyrocketed, and we've been able to produce a lot of more documents than if we just simply did it on paper. Besides leveraging translation memory, this tool also helps us maintain consistency in terminology, and it gives translators access to tools like auto-suggested dictionaries. As they're going along their translation, they have little suggested words that they may or may not use, but it allows them to work faster. And everything is faster and is of higher quality. This is the new tier structure for our services. Tier 1 describes the mandated services by either court order or federal law, and those are English language acquisition programs or special education. Charter schools, which I think sometimes are overlooked, we don't charge charter schools for special education-related requests, but we do charge them for anything outside of that. Tier 2, and is basically the bulk of our work is in Tier 2 because that's where all the schools' requests come through. And Tier 2 describes what's not required, but what Denver Public Schools has decided to support as best practices. So in order for parents to be engaged, in order for parents to be informed, Tier 2 considered essential services is where most of our requests come through. And Tier 3 is the only service that costs money. These types of requests are from third parties like a scholarship foundation or some vendor that the school uses, and those we do charge because they're not related to the district. For services that are outside of the scope of the languages that we serve, if let's say it's somebody wants services in TWI, but we don't service TWI yet because it's not in the top 10 or 13 languages, then we would have to charge for that language. And then we also charge for services. We charge schools and departments for services that are above and beyond what the department has done before. So many times they'll come to us with a huge, huge project, and we'll say we really don't have the resources for this project. We've never done it before. It's not factored into our budget. So we'll ask them for either help or to fully underwrite that project. And then Tier 3 also includes charter schools for requests that are not special education related. Another thing here. These are just quickly, you can reference these before. I think they've mentioned it before. These are the types of documents that we translate, just to name a few. This is the process grid for interpretations, which is a different process than translations. We obviously take the form online, the request, and it's all by a DPS employee. So the parent can ask a teacher, a social worker, anybody that works for DPS to request an interpreter. They go onto the portal, they request it, and then we triage it from there. Some for like special education, for example, because we took them on just last year as an internal client, some requests still go to them but then get filtered out back to us. They still handle a certain number of IEP requests, like Spanish reassessments and initials. I think they handle themselves, and then we handle Spanish annuals as well as anything outside of any language other than Spanish we handle. So they basically just handle a couple of the special ed type meetings and assessments. Moving on to the next slide here, this is just basically the grids that you saw before for translation, but these are for interpretation requests, and they're almost on par with the number of requests for translations. There's a little bit fewer requests for interpretations, but they're almost on par. And the growth there has just been phenomenal. As you can see there, we saw a huge spike in April of last year when we took the special education services in as an internal client. From March to April, there was a huge spike, and we'll see that in this school year as well. And these are the different types of interpretation services that we support. to name a few. We also have superintendent parent forms. There's a lot of stuff that we help schools with that is not shown here, but these are just some of the meetings that we do service. And then as a control factor, like I said before, we require a DPS employee to request services so that we can know we know that somebody is sponsoring that request. And they always have to go through our online portal to make that request, because then we capture all of the information one time, and we don't have to go back and forth with the coordination and logistic information that we need. So that's the process for requesting stuff. And then another thing that's important for us to do is to set general guidelines so that people know the process and kind of how we're set up. And also it helps us set reasonable expectations for the clients. And, well, that's it for my part. I'm excited to answer any questions you might have. My information will be posted whenever you print out the document, and you're free to contact me whenever. Hopefully that was very helpful for you. I'll stay online to answer any questions later. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Sal. And yeah, to all the participants on the call, I've noted down your questions for Sal, and I'll be sure to address some of them when we start the Q&A after we hear from Alejandra. And so with that, I wanted to introduce Alejandra Bosch from St. Paul, Minnesota Public Schools. Alejandra is the Translation Services Coordinator for St. Paul Public Schools, and that's a district where 43% of the students speak a language other than English at home. So she must face quite a number of challenges in doing her work, and we're really excited to have her on. And I'll turn it over to her now. Alejandra?
Thank you, and my name is Alejandra Bosch, as you mentioned before. I'm the Translation Services Coordinator for St. Paul Public Schools, a district that has around 38,000 students enrolled right now, and which 43% of them speak a language other than English at home. And this is decided by a law required by the Minnesota Department of Education that requires a home language code for all students. And based on that, we have 57% students that speak English and 20% Hmong, which is our largest group, followed by Spanish at 12%, Karen at 2%, Somali at 3%, and other languages at 6%. SPPS demographics shows that, let's look at 1990, and we had a percentage of ELL students, English language learner students, at 12%. And it has increased year to year. And in the school year of 2008-2009, the number was up to 41, and now it's 43%. St. Paul School students speak 126 languages and dialects, being the top 8 English, Hmong, Spanish, Somali, Vietnamese, Amharic, Karen, and Oromo. Our office, the Office of Translation Services, is under the Communications, Marketing, and Development Department, which is under the Chief of Staff, who reports directly to the superintendent. Being here makes us be in the front end of things instead of being on a reactive level, maybe in another department. We used to be in ELL before, but being in communications, we can be part of the creators of the document or the communication that they want to send out, and maybe look at different ways to send it out and try to see ways that are better, how to better communicate with our families that don't speak English. So the office was created in 2002 under the ELL department because we had a leader with a vision. The department director, Valeria Silva, was in the ELL office at that time, and she then moved to be the director of academics and is now the superintendent of our schools. So we do have a strong support in our office because this was, quote-unquote, her baby, and she wanted to make sure that all our families were being served, not only because of our legal requirements that you mentioned before, but also because our school board policy mentions that we need to provide services to families. We need to communicate with families that don't speak English. And we were seeing an increasing percentage of ELL students not only here in our inner district, but nationally. And because we have so many languages spoken in St. Paul homes, we wanted to make sure that we were able to reach out to as many of them, because we believe that if parents are involved in the school system, the chances of those kids graduating increases tremendously. And like other districts in the country, we do have strong family involvement, working staff here in the district. The difference is that they're not part of our office. They have their own office, the family involvement office, and we do work closely with them to provide support. We also work closely with special ed. We work closely with ELL. So we do provide services and support to all of those departments, but here from the Office of Communications. In terms of interpreting, our schools have bilingual educational assistants, and they speak Hmong, Somali, Spanish, Karen, Burmese, Oromo, Amharic, and Vietnamese. They are working directly with the students in the classroom, and they're also working as liaisons with the families and interpreting at conferences when needed. Besides that, it's decided to be there, it's because of the student language. So if a school has a high percentage of Karen and Hmong, that's where you're going to find staff that speak that language and so forth. On-call interpreters, we also have a list of on-call interpreters that are being used on occasions for interpreting, and their candidates are recruited through different methods. We might have a job fair in the fall, but realize that we need a newer interpreter and we don't have one on the list, and so we start looking throughout the community. We find someone, we invite them over, and they fill out all the paperwork at HR, and they take a language proficiency test here in the district, and they also do an interview. Once they've passed all this, they're part of this list that is being used district-wide, not including special ed. Special ed has their own hub of interpreters that they use for IEP meetings and other special ed meetings. They provide their own training. And they on occasion share, maybe depending on the occasion, but they have their own staff for their own use. Like I said before, they need to pass the test in order to be a part of the list, and they also will have to take a small training, more of a training, I would say, an orientation, get to know the district, to learn where are our schools located, what's the terminology we use. Who is going to answer questions whenever they have one, and where to go to troubleshoot. And we're also going to provide them with the bilingual educational glossary that was developed here in our office. So when they go to a building to interpret and they don't know the terminology for certain things, at least they can reference to materials produced by the district so we can have some consistency within the system. How are these interpreters being used for parent-teacher conference, school events, dismissal and expulsion hearings, district-wide events, graduation ceremonies, school board meetings, and other situations that may arise during the year or during the summer? The schools can also request interpreting technology. So if they need to have a large meeting and have simultaneous languages all at once in one room, we can allow for that. However, we've noticed and we've seen that parents tend to like to have a small group discussion when it comes to language meetings. So maybe depending on the situation, we'll tend to do a Spanish meeting, a Hmong meeting, and a Somali meeting if we have the capacity to do so. Translations. We provide translations in Hmong, Somali, Spanish, and Karen, and other languages upon need of district publications like the Back to School Guide, the enrollment document that we send out in December for parents to sign up for school for next year, testing letter, Title I, different letters to families. We also do in our office record mass distribution messages through a system called Connected. So if there's an incident at one of the schools and we need to inform the parents right away, we can record a message within minutes, send it out to the families, and they can get it in their phones or on their emails right away. We also work on video scripts for the school district for different things. Our staff is paid out of general fund, out of the general the communications general fund, and we work on translations for the district-wide translations for the Office of Communications. But we also take other documents from other departments, and we consider those depending on the funding and the need of them. And so let's say that we get a document from the Office of Title I, and it's a letter, it's required. Of course we're going to do it. That goes out first because it's essential. Then we take another document, which is maybe a letter for families explaining a policy. We do translate the letter. However, we also recommend that you should have a meeting in the school, invite the families over, and talk about it with your families and answer any questions you might have. Sometimes translations is not the end-all and be-all. You need to also provide the person-to-person support. We do translate for language groups that reach the 10% of the school population. However, if this, if the principal at the school decides that it would be better to translate it in Amharic, even though the population is not the 10% threshold, we will do it for them. This is just a guideline. It's not a law. It's not a policy, just a guideline. And we want to make sure that we take into consideration what the principals are saying because they are the ones that know their communities the best. There's benefits to having in-house translations. We have consistency. We provide glossaries to our staff. We funnel everything into one office. So from school to school, you will see documents that are translated the same. There's a better product in the, at the end. There's also the time. If you need to do something right away, we can do it in a few minutes and send it out. So we can, we're providing almost instantaneous services. And there's also the financial reason. We're not going out hiring people to do this on emergencies that end up costing a lot more than having staff do it within the system. Our challenges, we're constantly evolving, and we have to see the trends of our population and adjust our staffing accordingly. And with that, we also have to look at qualified interpreters and translators, especially in the newly arrived populations, and we might have to do a lot of outreach in order to find those people because there aren't many sometimes when it's a group that has just recently moved into the cities. We have to provide more or the same or more services with decreasing budgets. So we have to be more specific as to how we're going to do it and try to be very responsible how we're going to use our funding. And also there's this culture that we have to break that not because you know a language is going to make you an interpreter or translator. We have to have people with skills and with a background and experience. And we can't just call whomever from the community that you know that speaks French to come and interpret for you. We got to make sure that we have qualified people in our district. And that would be our presentation. And also, I am open to any questions that you may have.
Thank you so much, Alejandra. I wanted to begin the question and answer portion of the webinar. Based on the questions I've been seeing from both Sal's presentation, Laura's, as well as Alejandra's, I wanted to start off by asking Sal and Alejandra both to give a little bit more information about the intersection of providing language services for limited English proficient students in general, as well as the special ed population, and if you can talk both about, and I know Alejandra, you mentioned a little bit of this, but if you can talk both about what funds are used for each and whether there's overlap, and then how decisions are made for, say, providing services for LEP students who happen to have special ed needs. So, Sal, maybe go first. Thanks. Sal, you might have to unmute your line.
Oh, there I was muted, sorry.
Thanks.
You wanted to know about the intersection of the Spanish support as well as the other languages? Is that what the question was?
No, I think Sal, more about special ed, like some of the questions that, like, in your department, how you your department handles special ed, but in Alejandra's, they have the interpreters for special ed separately. Yeah. So maybe comment a little bit on that.
Yeah, the reason why we've kind of absorb the special ed component of the DPS of Denver Public Schools' needs was due to budget cutbacks. And we saw that they were having a coordinator do very much what our coordinator was doing. So, you know, we talked it out and we said we need to plan for this. We need to make it a smooth transition. We need to make sure that, you know, we are funded for this and that you will support it. And so they be the I guess it used to be the math department. Now it's the C's department, but it's basically student services. And what they needed to do was to just assure us that we were going to be taking on an additional volume of interpretations for these IEPs and that they were going to support us. And we communicated with them what they needed to be able to report. And one of the things that we hadn't tracked was student ID number and student name because of the privacy. We just know that they need an interpreter, and we didn't track that. But in order for them to be able to pay for it out of their funds, whether it be Title VI or any other federal fund, they need that student ID number. And so we agreed with them that we would invoice them, and for everything that we would do, we would track that student name and student ID. What we do also that's a little different, and because it has migrated from another department to our department, is that we've set up a service agreement with special ed that we are going to handle Spanish initials and – no, I'm sorry. We're going to handle Spanish annuals only, but we'll handle all needs for languages other than Spanish. The special ed department wanted to handle Spanish for initials and assessments. So that's kind of how there's a dichotomy there. They pick up certain types of meetings. We pick up other types of meetings. And there is, I think, a concern there for me because we handle our offices a little differently. And so I'd rather we basically service everybody in the same way. We're all within – we provide services within our legal requirements, but it just functions a little differently. I'm not sure if that answers your question.
Yeah, Sal, it does. Thanks. Alejandra, do you want to address that?
Yeah, well, like I said before, we do provide services district-wide, so all students are students no matter which label they have attached to their name. So we're providing services to all of them in terms of letters, recorded messages. It doesn't matter. Everybody's going to get that. However, the special ed department has their own staff of interpreters, and they provide special training, and they are sending out those people to work. They have cases, so it's the same interpreter that works with those schools, and so they get to know the families, and they work with them directly. And I do collaborate with in terms of translations with special ed, with Title I, with other departments, and there's been a talk of how we can combine all these services and maybe start servicing everybody from one place, but we're still on the talks in terms of that specific.
Great. Thank you, Alejandra. So a couple of other questions that the participants had revolve around the pros and cons of using telephonic interpretation and also the pros and cons of some of the translation technologies you've used. So, again, let's hear from Sal first and then from Alejandra.
Well, I think there are a lot of benefits of using telephone interpretation services. Basically, when you have the ability, we have the ability to connect with an interpreter in under 2 minutes for any kind of needs that might be a walk-in into the school's office, any kind of meeting where they can get a conference room setting, not a conference room setting, but an off like a private room setting with a conference line, and they can conduct the meeting like that. A lot of benefits too for telephone interpretation could be in the initial setup because I mean if you're a school staff member and you want to set up a meeting, it's hard to make that initial contact with the parents if you don't speak their language. So with telephone interpretation, you can at least do that and have and it's relatively short connection periods, and we have any language available within 2 minutes. Some of the cons would be that for an IEP type meeting, there could be some trust issues that the parent, you know, just doesn't want some stranger. You know, they'd rather have that person there that looks them in the face. They're treating very sensitive personal information. It could be that it's a conference setting, and so phone interpretation won't work. Let's say there's a big auditorium, the superintendent's going to speak, and he walks all over the place. That just it doesn't work. So there are some good reasons. Another reason would be that you're only charged for the minutes used, where with an interpreter, you're charged with the minimum. So whether the minimum's whatever it may be, if the meeting's 30 minutes, but you have a minimum of an hour and a half that you have to pay the interpreter, that's a much higher cost. But with a phone, you only pay for whatever length that call is, whether it be 5, 10, 15, 20 minutes. Even some meetings that are an hour long might be cheaper than having a physical interpreter there. For the CAT tools, there's an initial investment. The CAT tools meaning the tools used for translation, the software. There's an initial investment, and our investment was very close to $25,000, and that basically we started it 2 years ago, and so it was like seed money for us to just get the department set up. And that was just with a limited of seven licenses that we have. And so that's the drawback. Not everybody will have that seed money to start, but we had really good support from the superintendent to do that. Another drawback would be that, you know, it is a technology. So depending on how people are, your translators are very comfortable or not comfortable with technology, that could be something that you might want to think about. But I think the benefits are far better than the drawbacks for the CAT tools. We see the production go up. We see the resources that they have for the translation memory, the term base that is built to maintain terminology throughout the district consistently. The quality and then just the way that there's a system. There's an organization for everything. The benefits outpace the drawbacks by far.
Great, thank you. And Alejandra, same question to you. What have you seen in terms of the pros and cons of the telephonic interpretation as well as the translation technologies you've used?
We do not use translation technology in our district. We are looking into it, but we've had some questions about having it for us here too, and I think it's great, and I want to move forward towards that area, but I think you have to be careful also with some of the languages, like with the fonts. Like, for instance, Karen, I don't know, maybe Sal can answer that question for me too. Does it work with Karen language? Because I've heard that Trados does not really support that. And if phone interpretation, I like it when it's for something short. There's a lot that can be lost with having a phone and a machine. In terms of nonverbal, and when it gets too long, and the concentration level, it's a lot easier when you have a live person there. But we understand that sometimes that is not possible, and if you have to go and move towards that area, that's actually not a bad thing to do. And we're pretty lucky and fortunate in our district that we have a lot of bilingual staff in our schools that can help parents when they walk in. And whenever they can't find someone in the building, they call right away, and we try to help them out as much as we can, and we try to set up those phone calls. But yeah, I mean, it does help with short contacts.
Great, thank you, Alejandra. So I see that we have a voice question, so I wanted to give the voice callers an opportunity to ask.
So caller, you're unmuted.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
My name is Marissa. I'm calling from One America. It's the largest immigrant advocacy organization in Washington State. My question is for Sal regarding using the state identification for funding issues or federal funding purposes. We're coming across some issues with FAFSA and using the state school IDs for the FAFSA applications as well. And I was wondering if there are any implications regarding the status. The immigration status, you know, whether an undocumented student might have his or her status revealed as a result of sharing that information.
Thanks. And I think, with that question, I think maybe it's also important to broaden the question to include just how you all handle confidentiality issues in general. I'm sure each of your districts comes across this sort of sensitive topic. So Sal first, but we'd also like to hear from Alejandra about this.
Okay. If I understand the question correctly, I was referring to using student IDs, it was so that the funds could be released. It really has nothing to do with their immigration status. It is just so that the funding can then be used to pay for the services, and it stays internal. That is just for the controller for the student services to pay for us for providing the services. None of this information gets out to the public. The interpreters conduct themselves with the code of ethics of confidentiality agreements, and they this is not discussed publicly. The reference to the student ID was just so that we know that the student is in fact an IEP student that needs those services, and then we basically internally will use the funds from the student services to pay us back for conducting the service.
Thank you, Sal.
You're welcome.
Alejandra, do you want to just talk quickly about sort of how you've handled confidentiality issues?
Just going through the same thing is you got to make sure that they follow the code of ethics and making sure that they're not asking questions. They're only there to interpret what's being said between two parties. They're not going to start adding their own 5 cents here and there. That's not their job. And in terms of identification, our district does not ask for immigration status. We do not ask for I-94s. We do not ask for passports. We do not ask for visas, any of that. So that's not our deal there. We don't do that.
Great, thank you. So we have an interesting question here. For the school districts across the country that don't have anything in place, Sal and Alejandra, what would you say, how are they supposed to start? How would you suggest they start to develop a program for providing translation and interpretation if they don't have anything currently in place? And again, Sal first and then Alejandra.
I'll tell you how we did it, and I think my predecessor, Alex Sanchez, attended a conference, and in that conference he learned a lot about other school districts that had similar models, but nothing really quite like what we implemented here. But what you need, first of all, is support from the superintendent so that there's funding for this type of work. There's going to be funding that you'll need through general fund. And the majority, I would recommend that everything come through the general fund. However, there are other streams of funding that you can look for, whether it be Title I, where let's say there's a project that is funded by Title I that would meet the requirements, and then you can service that project with the collaboration and support of that whatever department using the Title I funds. Same thing goes for Title III. You'll need some Title III support because, you know, it's mandated. For us, it's mandated by a court order, and we need to fund some of those through Title III that are above and beyond what we normally do. So what is required, it can't be paid for by Title III, but if we go above and beyond, like let's say we hold a parent institute, that, for example, is above and beyond of what we normally do, and that could be funded by Title III. We also looked for grants, and we have received and are in the process of getting more grants. And those grants could be anything from like a health fund foundation. It could be an educational foundation. It could be just social integration foundation. You just have to find them and then go out, present what you do to them, and then they can decide whether they will grant you some money.
Great, thank you. Alejandra?
I would say start small, see what is required, and start there, try to gather the money for the required things first, and get a feel for what it is to have a translations office within your district. Identify first where do you want to place it, which is the best fit for it, and then look at other ventures. Let's see, grants like SALSID, community partnerships to provide help as well, and start pitching and saying and telling people we are doing this. This is fantastic. You have to come in and look at what we're doing and spread the word within the district of the fantastic job that it is to have an office that does this within the system and then grow from there.
Can I add something?
Yes.
One of the reasons why in the presentation I wanted to include organizational charts, volume of work that we do, then the process grids, was to kind of give you and the listeners the tools so that you can maybe try to implement those in your district. And so that's why I included those, so that you can have kind of a blueprint of what we do. If you want to talk more about the databases and the tracking that we do, I'd be more than happy to talk to people on how we track and how that helps our funding, because I think over 2 years ago there was no tracking. And that was very hard to make the argument that we needed more money. So the tracking part of everything became very important. And so as you're going forward and trying to set up the new shops, keep that in mind, that if you have tracking in place in that database and you take care of certain, data, that'll make the case for you to ask for more money. And later it'll be easier for you to do that.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Great. And Laura, I wanted to throw this question to you as well. For those school districts just starting out, what should they be keeping in mind when they think about communicating with parents, guardians, and students?
Yeah, thanks for bringing that up, Chandasi, because there were a few people I can see in the chat box who talked about, you know, well, our refugee and immigrant parents aren't very involved in their children's schooling, and someone else mentioned like cultural nuances and that kind of thing. And so I think kind of stepping back and also recognizing that besides the language issues, there's a lot to think about in terms of culture. And a lot of times just the idea of parent involvement as it's thought of typically in U.S. schools, that idea alone can be very foreign. And so It's not so much always just the logistical barriers, you know, transportation, childcare, so on and so forth. It's just a lot of times the concept of, you know, and expectations and an understanding of what those expectations are as far as parent involvement, and this idea of, oh, I'm going to talk to my child's teacher. We didn't do that in our home country. Why are we doing that here? You know, that kind of thing. So a lot of times those things just need to be explained and really just explicitly stated. And we have an article on involving refugee and immigrant parents in their children's education that talks about a lot of these things. It's on the publications page of our website. And just to remind everyone who may have just joined later on in the call, we also have a clearinghouse that has over 4,500 documents. And there's a lot of them are multilingual, and a lot of them have to do with parent involvement in the schools. And we also refer a lot on our website to MPI's language portal.
Great. And you know, this is Chandasi from MPI. I would add that, you know, in addition to our portal, there is www.lep.gov that also has information that should guide you all in determining what is a vital document that should be translated and how to go about assessing need. It's undoubtedly a very challenging challenging prospect, and there are resources here to help. You know, I had one additional question for Sal regarding the testing and training of your interpreters and translators. Can you talk a little bit more about how it's done and if you rely on third parties to do some of the testing and training, or if it's done internally?
Yeah, that's an ongoing struggle. But what we did was, for the most popular language group, Spanish, is that many years ago we have a professor that basically set up the rubrics and the testing for evaluating translators and interpreters for the Denver Public Schools. And so anyone coming in or that wants to be a candidate, we have to pre-screen them, test them, and like I said, if they score a 4.5 or 5, they have a much better chance of becoming an interpreter or translator for us. Of course, we always take into consideration if they're court certified. That's also a plus. We take into consideration if they're ATA certified, American Translation Association certification. That's also a big plus, although it's not required. And then those are just for basically general interpretation and translation needs. For anything that is very specific to student services or special education, we conduct a workshop, and it's a voluntary thing. We don't require them to attend because I can't pay for everyone to attend it. But what I do is I make it a prerequisite for us to use them in IEP settings for that type of job. And what they learn is code of ethics and standards. They learn some of the problems that might, you know, what do I do if a parent asks me, what should I do? You know, a lot of interpreters, they don't know what to do in those situations. So we in those trainings, we do role-playing, and we let them know how to handle that, basically letting the parent know that and communicating to everybody in both languages that, you know, what the parent had just asked that person, that they're going to step out of their interpreter role and tell the parent that they can't really get into advocating for the parent, but those are the types of things that we cover in this workshop, and those are very common types of scenarios that are problematic. And so we try to give them the tools to know what to expect, and also give them clinics on the terminology and the types of documents that are going to be asked that they're going to be asked to translate on site, perhaps. And so it is an 8-hour work session, and these are all interpreters that, you know, are professionals that either work for an agency or do it as a career. It's not really a workshop for someone that's just starting off, because it is more of a specialized workshop.
Great. Thank you very much. And we have time for just one last question, and we have a voice question, so we wanted to give the voice caller an opportunity to ask.
Hi, caller. You should be on the line.
Hi. This is Mina from Commonwealth Catholic Charities. I have a question about one particular population that we have where most of the parents are illiterate, and we have several documents that are mailed to them every week, and they are all important, and there's no way for us to find out about them until it's a very urgent issue when we get a call from the teachers, and we don't see it possible to get, you know, an interview with an interpreter every week to explain the mail, but they do have a lot of important things that they need to understand, but they cannot read them in their own language either. How do you deal with that situation?
I'll answer. That's going to be very difficult, I think, for many districts to address. But one of the things that we have as a tool is what we call a robocall. And I don't know if you've all heard of it, but it's a very useful tool that all you really need to do is record a short message addressing the parents for all sorts of categories. I mean, it could be make sure your student is there October 1st for the October count, you know, that type of message. We can call all the parents the previous night and let them know. And I know that logistically it might be something that you need 2 weeks to set up for multiple languages, but for languages like Spanish, we can do that internally and have it done and turn everything around in less than a day so that it goes out the next day. But for, let's say, there's something legal and it's got to go out in all languages, it usually takes about 2 weeks to have all of the languages then come back with a recording and then have all of the languages go out by, I think, at the beginning of the year, parents identify what language they speak, and so that the Department of Technology that we have is able to then send those messages to those homes in the language of comfort for that home. So that's how we address that. But other than that, I would say that partnering up with refugee organizations like the Colorado African Organizations that have navigators, and they're also one of the recipients, like I mentioned before, of the grant that Lynn was talking about. They do phenomenal work in getting in front of the parents. They go to the apartment complexes and use the courtyard as a meeting area. And what they do is they'll take, let's say it's a press release. They'll take a press release with them and basically site translate or summarize the press release to the parents. If it's something that they feel is important to that community, then they'll do that. And that's basically something that we have. We're very fortunate to have them as a partner, and they're able to help us with about six languages.
Great. Thank you, Sal. And Alejandra, with just the few minutes we have left, I'd like you to offer your two cents as well.
Okay. We do do a lot of phone messages. So the same as Sal was saying, we do record a message, and it goes out to the home. And the beauty of this system is that it lets us know, too, if they listened to the message or if the phone wasn't working, so we can try again and again and again until we get the parents to listen to it. The other thing, too, is that if there's a possibility to, like, make it a package of all the documents that are very important for the year and invite the parents over to a meeting at the school and make it like a parent orientation, talk to them about the process of filling out all this important paperwork, and that's something that it can be done through the Office of Parent Involvement as well. They have the know-how and the tools to do that, and then they can look at how important it is for them to fill out the information, also to get to know the teachers, to understand the importance of them being involved in their kids' education. Try to talk, like Sal said, also with media, the radio, which is the radio that they listen to. Try to make it a call there saying that there's been important messages going out to every home in, let's say, St. Paul schools. Look at your kid's backpack. If you don't understand what it says, please give us a call. You got to try different ways, but sometimes the written documentation is not the only way to reach out to our parents. And that's when it's so important to make a call, to do a person-to-person communication. And maybe in this case it would be good to use a phone interpretation if they don't have the funds to have someone come into the district to interpret for them.
Thank you, Alejandra. So this concludes our 90-minute webinar. Just a reminder for those of you who might have joined late, the PowerPoint slides with active links will be available on MPI's website, and we'll send out an email letting you all know when it's up, as well as the audio. I noticed there are some questions that I didn't get to, so I will try to follow up with Laura, Sal, and Alejandra to get those questions answered for you. And finally, I just want to take a moment to thank all of our participants as well as our presenters. Thank you especially to Lynn Moreland, Laura Gardner, Salvador Carrera, and Alejandra Bosch for the great work that you all do, and for sharing your insights on this important issue. Please stay tuned for more MPI Language Access webinars exploring other aspects of providing interpretation and translation services for limited English proficient populations. Thanks, everybody.
For information and to access past Language Access webinars, please visit www.migrationpolicy.org/languageportal.